When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Recording in progress.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Mr. Hawkins.
Hello, you. How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Good, thanks.
So I've finally got a Return of the Jedi replica.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Which, nerding out is a master replica, so took me like 9 months to find one on eBay.
Oh, bless you. What, is it just the handle, though? Is it?
Just dropped it.
Oh, no, he's broken it.
He's broken it. It's all over.
Oh, no, I'm done.
Rebels will be pleased.
Is it just the handle, then, or does it do anything
it's
like that?
Yeah, it's just the handle. Oh, yeah, we don't do hilts. Come on. We don't do the blades.
Oh,
I mean,
oh.
You know, come on.
You can probably hit each other in that, can't you? Apple are asking us to test those magic goggles next week. You know, there's like the Minority Report.
Yeah.
So we came out to London to
I'm
go and
so
have a play with that.
Jealous, because
but
are
I'm
you?
Not technical. They said,
do you want
course.
To go instead of me?
Oh my god, I'm obsessed with. I'll probably walk out and bought one because. My composer.
I mean, like a ridiculous amount of money.
I know, they're stupid, which is why I can't justify it, because it would just be a really expensive gimmick that is in the corner of my room.
They've said things like, of course, if you, you know, maybe bring your own spatial content, you know.
Of course.
Like,
oh, yeah.
What the? What? Yeah. What does that mean?
You don't have spatial content, mate. Come on. You're supposed to be the forefront iPhone people, okay?
I know, but like iPhone, not content. Magic goggles. I know. But then also they want to know what prescriptions and stuff, so they can put
like
Aspera lenses in it.
Yeah.
Wait, so I've got to take my contact lenses out in order to look through this thing?
No, keep your contacts in, but they'll adjust. Because their whole thing
Phil,
is like looking... When is it? Where is it?
Seriously, Phil, you should go.
Yeah.
I think that they look super cool. I have no idea how I would use it, but like I had my composer who did, Robin, did some thing for Apple, like design or something for one of their films. And so he they gave him one, because as you do.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so he sent me a live recording of him composing my film, his point of view of it. And he had like the film floating in a window like there. And then he had a bigger film like playing like IMAX style, so he could look up and it just looked huge. And then he was adjusting some volume just by like holding the air and doing this. And he was composing with the thing on and stuff.
I mean, that's kind of
And the freaky thing is that you don't even have to gesture. It knows what you're looking at. So you can actually, it almost reads your mind. Like you can, it knows.
I'm going to point out that in 1984... Terminator, they said in 40 years time they would have the technology to come kill us. That is now.
Wow, that is
this is how
now.
It begins, and we're part of it. I'm so sorry, people.
So yeah, anyway,
no, that's
expensive
cool.
Toy for I don't know why you would use it, but it does look
we'll let you know.
Yeah. Although the 360 version of Dagger would be interesting.
Yeah.
Do you know what? My friends did, they did make movies or shorts on the 360 camera for a while. Did you see some of those?
I remember that. Yeah.
Dagger would have been an interesting version
I bought
of
one
that,
of those.
Wouldn't it?
What was it called?
Phil just bought one of those, by the way. Oh, I bought one of those.
It was like a 360 camera. It's actually pretty good. It's just sat in a box. But I, for a while on like my fledgling YouTube channel, I did some like 360 things where you could like spin around, and they're actually really quite cool. Like I just put them on set and then filmed, and people could look around and stuff.
Yeah, and so it's a bit like those, I don't know, on Facebook you get the Egyptian go to the pyramids and you can go in and look around. So that's a 360 camera basically that they've put in.
You can use these Apple things for that. That's fun.
The Vision Pro, basically the reason why it's different is like it's super high resolution, which is why they want to know your contacts, because the idea is that looking into it should be no different than real life. So,
yeah. I don't like it. So, but
you know what's freaky is that when someone looks at you, they avatar your eyes onto the front of it. So, like, when you look at someone, it looks like you're looking back at them, and
that's,
you know,
that's
and even weirder. Is that when you, when, if we did something like this in the Vision Pro, you guys would appear as like avatars, like, hey, how you doing? And you'd be able to like point and go, come over here and stuff. It's mental.
I'm blue.
It's mental.
There's something about it, right, that is kind of magical. If you could capture the film, a film, or you are now entering a film, especially horror films, imagine that and you're in that world. Like, properly, and it's a, you know, it's an Insidious type movie, and you're in there, but it's a movie. You know, it's a beginning, middle, and end. That would be
different level. I got the Oculus.
And
the Oculus has got like a, it's a bit gamey, but it's a story based kind of Star Wars thing, and it's kind of terrifying at times because Vader like storms straight up to you, and he's like really imposing. It's like 3D sound, and like, and you're kind of trapped, and it's quite, and they, all the lights go off, and it's a sound design and lighting and stuff, and it's actually really cool. It's like really affecting.
I feel like this is where you'll die.
The next film's going to be on the Vision Pro, right? I'm not even joking.
Yeah,
like. You know, if you can wrangle a couple of Vision Pros,
I mean, I'll talk.
And
to
a couple
them.
Of 360 cameras.
Yeah, sorted.
Bob's your uncle.
Yeah. Let's go and do it.
Yeah.
Have we started, by the way, already? Or just...
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm using all this. Well, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast. This is episode 392.
Hey.
Of the Filmmakers Podcast. So today on the show, as you've already heard, I've been joined by Phil Hawkins as my fellow host today. Hello, Phil. How are
you, buddy? I'm very well, thank you. I'm good.
I love that you turned into host mode there.
I have become host mode. Hello.
Hello, R2-D2. Speaking of R2-D2, Phil is the director of Star Wars Origins, the very, very, very well-received Star Wars fan film that he made. But he's also the director of the last show in Prancer, A Christmas Tale, which... which is fantastic. And his latest movie, Robin and the Hood, which stars Naomi Harris and Gwendoline Christie, as well as a whole host of kids. And he's just delivered the film, which must be amazing. How are you, Phil?
I'm good, thank you. Staring into the void of unemployed filmmaker.
But, it, I mean, like, finished of delivered. Are you delivering Robin?
It's done. Right, I'm now? Done. Literally, tomorrow is the QC of the DCP. That's it. I'm done. It's over.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I love that you say it's over, but next comes the whole marketing.
As not a producer and it not.
Right. I was,
you know, yeah. It being a Sky movie, it's kind of like there are departments of clever people that do this stuff.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we were talking about today, because we're going through that. To be honest, hell at the moment, trying to get your film out there.
And
we
were saying, delivery hell.
And you say, like, oh, but all filmmakers do. I was like, well, no, like, say, for example.
No deliverable
Phil,
sheet
you,
for him.
It's a
no.
Really decent budget, I don't know if you want to say. Really decent budget film, Sky film. He's not going to have to do all this nonsense that we're doing at the moment.
That
they keep sending you new things. Go, oh, did we not send you this?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we need that last week.
No, okay, no dialogue list for you.
I've made a bunch. I've been there, my friends. Like, why do you need an M&E of a blah, blah, blah from a blah, blah, blah? Why does Albania need this? I don't understand. You know, so I've been there, my friends, and I'm not going back. So maybe not.
But that's the point. And we keep saying, but look, honestly, when we get a budget, we're not going to have to do this nonsense.
Yeah.
Someone else will do it.
I think each time it's like, this is the last time.
For those who haven't done this joyous thing, what we're talking about here, the deliverables list is the bane of most producers' lives. Once you get to that stage, if you haven't made a film yet, prepare yourselves. We have done podcasts on this somewhere. Search for it in the website, thefilmmakerspodcast.com. You should see them there somewhere. But you have heard them. And we haven't introduced them properly yet. They are our guests today. Matthew and Tori Butler Hart have directed and produced and written many feature films and loads of shorts as well. But the feature films they have produced with their production company Fizz and Ginger Films in the last 10 years are Miss in Her Teens, Two Down, The Isle, Infinitum Subject Unknown, which stars Ian McKellen, and the latest film, Dagger, which are pretty much here to talk about. Of course, they also have their book, which is A Modern Guide to Independent Filmmaking for all those wonderful indie filmmakers out there wanting to get stuff made. This is the book for you. It's called Full to the Brim with Fizz, Ginger and Fierce Determination. Link to that will be in the show notes, I hope, if I do it. And they will be making their 360 Splattervision movie Daggers. Coming to a cinema soon. Coming soon to a Splattervision near you. And often fellow The Filmmakers Podcast hosts. Welcome back, Matthew Butler-Hart and Tori Butler-Hart.
Thank you, Joe. Hello.
That was a really small hello. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having us back.
And we're here to talk about Dagger, which is out now.
It is out now.
Hey.
It is out now. On what platforms can people watch this?
So it is out now in America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. It was last week. And then this week now, it's the UK and Ireland, and it's on your Skies, your Amazons, your Apples, your Rakutens, your Microsofts.
All good booksellers everywhere.
Google Play.
Wherever you can buy, rent.
Exactly. Yeah. Buy or rent. We're at the buy or rent stage.
Buy or rent.
Yeah, and all good or evil streamers, you are there, pretty much. Anyway, there'll be a link to that in the show notes, the website, and you really should watch this film. It's a joy. It's brilliant. It is fan footage magic. The reviews have been coming in and smashing out amazing reviews.
Amazing. Honestly, guys, I'm so happy for you.
90%
of them. Congratulations for A, making a film, B, getting it out there, C, it being in cinemas. Yep. We'll get into all this probably.
Yes, hopefully.
And D, like, just like to get those kind of like Empire Magazine and all these people that filmmakers would just fall over themselves to get a quote from or a review from, and you're just getting them in spades is and well deserved. I've seen the film twice. So very well deserved. And it's so.
It just
gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling when A, the kind of Filmmakers Podcast alumni are making stuff, but also just good people making good stuff, right? It's just so cool.
I always agree. I love that. I love seeing when people like, oh, like we said, it's about when you're doing your Sky thing. I was like, I'm so
your
happy.
Little Sky.
I didn't say little Sky thing.
No, you didn't.
I didn't say little. Okay, right. I didn't say that. Yeah, you're like, oh, great. Like, people, nice people are doing good stuff. That's just so nice.
It is. And you deserve it. It's amazing. Do go watch and support indie films. Okay. Let's dive into it. Let's dive into, you know, how someone else could go and make a film like this. For one, let's talk about budgets. Let's talk about how it came about. Let's talk about the whole process behind it. Like you said, you hadn't made a found footage movie before, but you had shot on iPhones with Infinitum Subject Unknown, your movie before this, which is again fantastic, did fantastic well, starred Ian McKellen, brilliant. Let's talk about this one. Let's dive into the process behind it. Why do another film on iPhone, for one? Why did you want to make this fan footage movie? Two questions in one. Go.
Okay. The initial idea came about because we were chatting to our distributor, our American distributor from Infinitum, Subject Unknown. And they were basically just like, oh, we want to get into producing some stuff. You know, we've got like a little bit of cash, but not much. Like a really minute amount. I think it was like $15,000.
No, it wasn't even that.
Well, not even that.
It was about like $7,000.
Yeah, like, that's what they wanted to make a found footage film for. And they were like, can you guys do that? And we were a bit like, that's a crazy low number.
We do like paying people. Like, this is not a big budget film at all. But like, we can't pay people and do good post-production for that.
I mean, what it also turned out, though, is that they all are also not very good at paying people.
Yes.
For example, us. So they didn't actually pay us the money owed to us from Infinitum Subject Unknown.
But we didn't go with them for that. Right.
So we went, no, you know what? We're not going to go into business with you guys and make a found footage film with you. But I think by that point, the seed had been sown, hasn't it?
We've come up with different ideas and we're like, we've never made one. I've always been a bit scared of it because they're so, so different from how you make a conventional film, which is a bit like a red rag to a bull for me. I'm like, okay, well, I don't know how to do it. I haven't done it. We should probably have a go at that.
Yeah.
It might be a massive mistake, but I'll have learned some stuff. We'll have learned some things. And it should be fun because, you know, that's kind of how we make films. Like, if it's going to be fun, that's probably the thing we should be doing. You know, it's kind of our philosophy, really.
Sorry, I was just I should probably say that it wasn't actually the distributor. It was the sales company for America because the distributor was Gravitas.
Okay,
and they're
good.
Great.
Okay, because people might have looked that up.
Exactly. Just clarifying. I'm like, oh, no. Wait, hang on a minute. No, it was the sales guide. Yeah. Gravitas,
okay, so
great.
So basically the sales team came to you and said, hey, look, we've got a bit of money. We think you should make a fan footage movie. You went, no, because for various reasons, but that idea stuck.
Yeah.
How then did you move from there to going, let's do this ourselves? Where did you find the money, I suppose, is the first thing? Or did you not even think about it at that point?
Ooh, well,
we did. I mean, obviously we were but I think we did a rough kind of budget of like, what's the actual bare minimum that we can make this for? As in, you know,
just the filming
side of things. None of the posts, none of the sort of aftermath, but just literally get it in the can. And we, because of shooting Infinitum on iPhone, we already had the sort of a relationship with Apple. And so sort of approached them about it and said, you know, will you give us the kit at least to go and make this? And so
yeah, they didn't give us the money. They haven't got a lot at the moment. So
no, they're a bit harder.
Apple or whatever platform it's called, Phil. Struggling with money.
No, that wasn't the idea, because also we were told though that like there's certain rules to found footage, and one of them being that if you have too big a budget, the found footage people are like, that's not proper found footage.
The reason why we didn't get Apple to give us the money. They were offering too much. We were like, the fans aren't going to love
too
this,
much.
Guys.
What I want is 30 grand.
Yes.
it's not a true story. But yeah, no, but that's, I think maybe we did go a little small in the end. But compared to other fan footage we discovered. But that's kind of, we went, okay, well, it needs to have that DIY feeling. So let's do it. Let's kind of go old school. It's our smallest budget yet, to be honest.
Yeah, but I think also because it was just about timing as well. So we were like, you know, we sort of just got to the point where like, we want to make something. It had been
3 years since we'd filmed Infinitum.
Yeah, two since it had been released or something. So we were a bit like, we just got to make something. And so I think I went on Airbnb. Mm-hmm. I went on Airbnb, looked up large houses in Wales. And then sort of worked out, okay, well, because we'd had our rough, we'd done the pitch, so we had the rough kind of storyline and script. Right. So we knew like how many characters, and obviously the easiest way of saving money is, can you house everyone in the same location and use it for both accommodation and location? And so, yeah, it was literally like, okay, well, this is how many actors we've got. Maybe Graham will also be the first AD. That would be good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like basically asking our actors if they'll double up and do crew jobs as well. Mm-hmm. And then so I think it sort of got to the point where we're like, okay, cool. These are the houses that we can get that will sleep 12 people or whatever. And then whittled it down and basically just messaged them and said, hi, we'd like to shoot a film in your place. Is that all right? And the guys from the house that we filmed at said, yeah, it's probably best to email us off Airbnb and then we'll discuss it. And so that's what we did, basically.
Yeah. But he gave us sort of, he said, okay, well, my birthday is this weekend, so we're going to come and use the house there. And it's the King's Coronation that weekend. So you've got 2 weeks. I went, okay, so we've now got kind of our time then. We've got...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our shoot schedule.
And we also know when we're starting. We haven't written the script. We haven't got all the money. We haven't got the cast or the crew, but we know when we're starting. So it kind of gave us a bit of a, you're doing this or not, because we also paid. We had to pay for the Airbnb.
Yeah.
That's the only bit of money we've got at this point. So we'll pay for the Airbnb and then we will make sure it happens.
Yeah, because I think sometimes that is when you are, you know, working on this minute, microscopic level of no budget. I think sometimes you can tie yourself in knots by just kind of going, oh, yeah, but oh, we just need this. And oh, let's just get that. And actually, if you literally just go, this is the date, come hell or high water, we are filming something. Mm. It kind of makes you do it.
It depends on the film, because obviously we couldn't do that with Drag Heist, for example. Because
Which
is your bigger budget.
As in if we went, I'm saying that, we are having to tell actors when the dates are and we haven't got any of those things. So I recant.
I think it works on every level. It's that psychological thing of, because there's never enough, as you say, there's never enough money, there's never enough time. Yeah. There's never, you know, there's actors always, you know, especially if you're playing the cast game, you know, like to not read it for ages, and you don't want to move on because you don't want to lose that person or that stuff. And when you've, you know, you're either got a 2-week expensive holiday somewhere that, you know, you probably wouldn't have holidayed, or you're going to make a movie, like you make a movie.
Yeah.
That's what I love about these 4-hour film challenges and all the stuff, because at the end of the 4 hours, you've got your movie and you had nothing beforehand and now you've got something. And so it's brilliant that you're going, well, I know the location, I can, and I'm assuming that you did this, we're going to write it for the location, but also knowing that you're going to film it on iPhone, I suppose. Those are the ingredients you knew going in, right?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
What I found really interesting was, because on, you know, Subject Unknown, like, that did not look like an iPhone film. Like, I was really surprised at, like, it was shot on iPhone and you did an amazing job of making that just look like a, inverted commas, normal movie.
Right.
And this time you kind of flipped it and we know it's iPhone and you're actually using it for a narrative device at times. Yeah. Like, it's like a film within a film, which is so clever. So, could you talk a little bit about, you know, because everyone's like, oh, get the idea, and, you know, and then it grows and stuff. And you've gone, well, these are all practical things. These are the things we've got, and this is how we're going to tell our story. So can you talk a little bit about how those ideas came across?
I mean, I think you're right, because we often kind of do that. We kind of probably do things the wrong way around. We'll kind of have, like, say, with the Isle many years ago, we had an island and then we reverse engineered. Okay, so what could possibly be shot here? Same sort of thing with this one. Okay, we found footage, we got this house, it's iPhone, it kind of, the medium almost dictates how we do things. When okay, these are the restrictions, we've now got the parameters that we can build the story in. We already had a kernel of an idea of a story, which is how we could do a tiny budget,
and that was kind of very much dictated to us by the rules, kind of in quotation marks, of found footage. That I think one of the main kind of driving forces behind the idea for the narrative was that we felt really that there needed to be a legitimate reason why they continue to film. That so often when you watch a found footage, you're a bit like, you would have put the camera down by now. Like, what? You know, whereas I think we, with the whole conceit of having the YouTubers, I mean, you know, that is what they do. Like, that is absolutely their life is filming everything constantly all the time. And so it was.
But also the fact that our filmmakers had gone to film school, so it wasn't just they're kind of like, hey, we're being YouTubers. They're trying to make a sort of program.
Yeah.
You know, so they're putting it together. They're thinking
they have
about
that
editing.
Ambition.
They're thinking
exactly
that way around. When, well, we need the footage, otherwise we can't cut to this, we cut to that.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, it wasn't just YouTubers running around like nutters, because that's not my sort of thing that I want to watch.
When you said, right, we've got the location, we've got what we know. We know these are probably our actors we're going to use. At that point, as Phil's question is, did the story evolve? Because, you know, we'll get to what the story actually is. But did you then go, okay, well, it is going to be YouTubers for that reason. Therefore, the story is, you know, we know the kind of actors, this YouTubers will be cool because then we're filming. Did then the story, you know, of the whole creature Welsh sort of mythology.
The kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Did it come out of that?
Well, that's the bit of the idea that I'd already sort of had. So for a while, I've been wanting to make a sort of conventional horror film about a kind of Thelma and Louise type character, because I love Thelma and Louise, but kind of modernized, and but it's, you know, horror. So they accidentally steal some sort of ancient artifact, wake up some demony beast thing, and then end up sort of in this big spooky house. That's as far as I've got. It's been rattling around my brain for a few years. I mean, well, hang on, why don't we use that as our kind of kernel but then obviously
that was sort of what we pitched way back to the sales guys, so we already had like that
but then
we got that far,
but then we thought, okay, well, let's, you know, it's us, we like to make our life more complicated than it is. So let's have another layer in. Let's have another story in there. So then we, at one point, it was a kind of a birthday party. There were caterers. And then you came up.
Yeah.
You were like, but why would they be filming?
Why would the birthday party be filming? And then obviously there's always like, oh, well, you know, you want to document the event and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but you'd put it down. If you're blowing your candles out and a demon comes out of your cake.
Yeah.
You put your camera down. But filmmakers who were trying to do it to kind of for insurance so they know that these accidents are not their fault and all that kind of stuff, and they're trying to save their own bacon sort of career-wise because they're not thinking they're going to die and things, then you go, well, that's
a bit more plausible.
That's a bit more plausible. Yeah. And, you know, of course, all the arguments are like, why are you still filming and, you know, all that kind of classic sort of stuff. But we try to sort of make sense of that. But all those things, as Tori said, the rules of those things dictated a lot of our story for it. But it did kind of grow. And then...
And I think we were just both really fascinated by the idea of kind of two timelines happening at once. And that
how
when
do we film
they
that?
Collide,
it's
like if Nolan made a found footage film. It's like the dream within the dream.
Phil, can we use that, mate? If Nolan made a found footage.
No, but it's interesting because it's like it is. Yeah, you say about convention and rules, right? There's a lot of inverted commas rules in horror, rules of the genre. There's the kind of the thing that everyone wants from a found footage film, but wants it to be different, at the same time, so it feels fresh.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I really liked for me and the success of it for me watching was this idea that, you know, on the outside, it was a found footage film because the footage was found, and then within the film, they're finding footage that has been shot, that's part of the story.
Yeah.
Which is why I said if Nolan made found footage films. But that layer made me go, okay, that's really clever. That's really smart. And I really liked that. And then I wasn't even thinking about this whole why they're filming or why they're not filming. You're just along for the ride at that point. It makes total sense.
Yeah.
I just thought it was super clever. Because it's iPhone and like iPad, isn't it? And stuff. Yeah. So it's like using... We sound like a sponsored podcast now.
I'll try. Yeah.
So I know, Matt, from your perspective, like as a filmmaker, I'm like you, right? I don't think I could make a found footage film because I'm all about the frame, all about the shot. I'm all about moment to moment, and I need the control of it, right? So how did that feel as a director, you know, going and doing this? Because you've made, like, in inverted commas, conventional, beautiful looking films, and now you're kind of giving this thing to, let's face it, the worst camera operators ever, actors.
Oh, yes. No.
Yeah.
But, like, how did that feel, like, liberating that and just being like, okay, here you go?
It did. I know you're spot on because I'm so into my sort of visual storytelling. And, you know, every time a camera moves, it's telling a story. Every time an actor breathes or an eye moves, oh, it's a new story. But then to go, look, here's your camera. See in a couple of hours, and you just go, oh, I hope that's going to come out. But because everyone knew that, I think that's why we built it into the characters. We have filmmakers doing a commercial. They know what they're doing technically. We've got YouTubers who, you know, they're YouTubers, but as in they're filmmakers, they also know what they're doing. So we sort of built that into the character. So then I gave a sort of an essay on cinematography to the actors and go, look, don't think I'm crazy, but like this is kind of, just think about these things. So when you're filming, you know, you can think about negative framing. So if you're hiding behind a tree, you're looking this way, maybe there's some space over here to create a bit of tension and stuff. So they played a lot, which was great. So I was still able to sort of get some ideas of the visual sort of in there. And it's not, you know, obviously there's a bit of shaky stuff at the end because we were told you have to have that because it's found footage. But on the whole, it's not, I don't think it's too typical of that sort of found footage. You know, we still managed to find ways of making it look nice. At some points, they did too good a job. And then our DOP, Pete Wallington, was like, we have to do that again. And we've got to make it rougher because no one's going to believe this is real.
Yeah. Well, because also, I mean, because as you said, like Pete was there and you and both you and Pete were working very closely together on, you know, what the shot composition was going to be. And we rehearsed, you know, a sequence kind of quite theatrically. You know, we'd go over and over and over it sort of thing. And then we'd shoot, you know, and, you know, okay, yeah, some of the takes would be like 5-10 minutes long, sometimes more, but we, you know, it was all plotted and planned, and you did storyboard still. I mean,
yeah.
half of them went out the window, but
yeah, because I did my sort of classic story thing, and then, like, for example, one of the characters, I don't know if you, oh, it's out, spoiler. Anyway, a big thing happens to Emma, and in the story, she was meant to have the camera when the thing happens, and then we kind of plotted through because things kept changing the script, obviously, because we went, we can't actually do that. We've had an idea for a scare. We can't accomplish that in the time and the money we've got. Okay, let's think of something new. And then we kind of went, by the time this character gets to where she's going, there is no way she is carrying a camera anymore. It's just too unreasonable to think a human would do that. Okay, so we need to scrap that, which means that my little shots of what happens, gone. We've got to really simplify it, rely on just two little kind of shots.
Well, I think it was as early as when the incident happens. And because she, after that, we were like, why would the she first, then pick up at the first?
Well, also because we cranked her up, went, let's kind of balance her because of what Matt was doing and stuff. It was fun though, because we were really collaborating with the cast. So every night we'd go through all the scenes of the next day and we'd all work out stuff together. Because it was just, all filmmaking is, puzzles and putting all the pieces together. I've never found it as much as with a fan footage though.
Yeah.
Because it's constantly shifting.
Because the narrative was really, really dictated by the performances as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think until you're there in that situation, finding those levels, the different levels of reactions and performance from the actors, so that would then dictate what they would be, obviously, how they would be behaving, but then also then how they would then be filming, not filming, all of that kind of stuff. So actually, really, you're sort of, your whole narrative is then kind of...
Well, and also kind of to go back to Phil's thing of giving away control as well. Script-wise, I'm quite specific as well. I'd like input from actors, but we discuss if we change lines. This was, we've got a basic script, but make it your own. So it was, it's improvised as well. So you've got these three lines. We need these three points to be made in this scene, but otherwise, have at it and see what happens. So to let go of that sort of the script side as well, which also meant, I wasn't expecting the scene to go that way, but it's just naturally happened when you got six actors running around. Let's just see what happens next. So it was
herding cats.
Yes,
in the nicest possible way.
In the nicest possible. Well, that must have been really interesting for you. Again, we'll jump back in a minute onto pre-production before you got to set, but just on that, Matt, how was it for you as a director, and to kind of follow on of Phil's question, being on set, not just with them running off and stuff, but what your mindset during that time when you can't be in the room or you can't hear it or you can't see playback, how did you process that as a director in terms of, because I know what we all do is we edit the film as we're shooting it. It's in our heads. We go, I need that shot. That could cut to that. I need the wide here. I need another close up to make that work. We're always editing in our heads as we go. I feel we are anyway. If we're not seeing the footage, it must be difficult because you don't know what you've got. What were you doing during that? What was your process like during that time?
Well, so we did actually have, we'd set up through using Apple TV and then a third party app. We had a monitor.
Yeah.
So we could, up to a point, watch the footage. We had six cameras going sometimes. Yeah. So a lot of time it was lagging because we were in Wales and there's ghosts and things, and stuff would break up.
But
keep, yeah. So we could keep a track on the whole.
And
sure. So we'd flick around going, okay, we've got that moment there. I think we've got this moment. I think that works there. But at the same time, you go, oh yeah, we'll have a close up there. Well, hang on. We can't have a close up there because it means the actor's going to have to move forwards. And there's no reason that Tori pick up the camera and go into a close up there. So unless we could build it into the story, that little story point that we'd like to get, it's gone. How else do we sort of do?
Yeah. And you had Will, our editor, was there as well. So it was like,
which
you,
we always liked doing. DOP, I always liked
it. He and Will editing.
Sweating, going, how many cameras on this
being
one?
Like, much footage.
Exactly.
DOP. Like six cameras and a 10-minute take. Oh my God.
But then we'd go and review it at night time and see if things, not that we had the time or the space to fix anything, but at least we go, I'm beginning to get an idea of the arcs of where stuff is going, at least. So for the next day, because it wasn't done chronologically, but we had the whole advert team 1 week and then the YouTubers the next, and there's crossover days, obviously.
Yeah.
But at least I could see the character arcs of where people are going. So I had a bit more of a grasp of that. But it was just, it was not how you'd normally think about.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, Feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Not I normally, so it's a lot of playback, but in terms of for other people who are thinking of doing that or might be making a found footage movie, directing wise, is it a case of you've just got to let them go with it and then hopefully you can look at playback?
Yeah, I just approach, well, we've only done this once with the found footage, but still approach it as if it's a conventional film. I don't see any other way of doing it. Mm. You know, everything has to be thought of as if it is a conventional film on a conventional set. Do your planning, do your storyboarding. Know that most stuff will be thrown out, but at least you've still got those beats and those arcs in their way. Okay, I need this stuff for the story. Stuff is going to change, but to hit this stuff, and of course that's going to change, at least you have some kind of plot and plan.
Yeah.
And same with the technical stuff as well. It's kind of, okay, you're using iPhones, but you're not just picking up an iPhone and running around. You know, it's still all the sound design. All that stuff has to be thought about otherwise.
Well, and also there is, you know, there's a third-party app that we used, which then allows, you know, much more control over what you're shooting. So it's not as if you are actually handing an iPhone to actors and being like, off you go, guys.
Yeah, it was all set up by Pete the DOP and stuff. Yeah. And like all the actors had to do was press record. And everything was set up properly for each scene. We'd review things. We might have to make changes. So it's still, from that kind of point of view, very much like a real film, conventional film.
Yeah. I think maybe just your shoot day shifts slightly in that you obviously need to not allow for so much setup time because you're not setting up loads of lights and da-da-da. And actually, it was preset. The lighting was all preset. So it's, you know, 360 because it needs to be because you don't know where the camera's going to be.
You know, those magic bulbs and things hidden around. Same with microphones. And then you just...
But you just allow for a lot more rehearsal time. Mm. So, you know, it's just, that setup time that would be
for
you.
We might rehearse for an hour,
Dolly,
film for 20 minutes,
right,
but then you've got everything you need because it's done.
Right.
So can we just touch on that? Just because obviously people say this about you hear like even big time directors say all the time. It's like, don't just not make a film. Pick up your iPhone. You've got a studio in your pocket, blah, 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 and go make a film, right? You know, and sometimes that can be very frustrating to hear.
Yeah.
and sometimes you think, oh, if it's that simple, why isn't everyone doing it? And I think what you're illustrating is actually, it's not as simple as that. And I think that's really interesting. So you use this app to, I guess, control exposure and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Can you tell us what the app is? So I'd be Googling it.
Yeah, so we used, so for this one, we used a British one called Cinema P3. And the reason we used this one, because we used... Filmic Pro for Infinitum. Things have changed, and we basically wanted, well, Pete wanted to make changes specifically for our film, and because it's a smaller company, Cinema P3, we could just email them, go, look, today, can you change this on the app? And he was so responsive.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
Give me an
hour.
Yeah, they were incredible.
Yeah, so it was brilliant. And it's, I think it's not, it's like 30 quid or something that. So, but then it's like, because Filmic Pro now, they are really good, but there's now subscription. And they're not as, they've been taken over by different companies.
They're a much bigger company.
But yeah.
And it's still a fantastic app.
Oh, gotcha. Like, yeah.
It will, it's a, they, both of them are kind of game changers for
giving
phone
control.
Shooting.
Yeah. It's why, you know, so like Infinitum, it was shown in American cinemas and they didn't know it was shot on an iPhone because they didn't want to tell them that because it wouldn't make as much money. Mm. But, you know, you can do that. We, you know, but we have to still have to use like ND filters.
Yes.
You know, because of the lights.
Say, so what is it's not just the phone, right? You've got in like a harness, have you got an extra lens on it? Are you using filters? Like, you know, what is the addition, the optional extras that, you know, you're going to sting me for when I come here?
Well, no. to be fair, we got some really cheap ND filters, to be honest. They're like £20 or something, a little kind of magnetic thing on the front. We didn't use different lenses because, like, to be fair, I don't work for Apple, but so, like, the new lenses, we'd use the 14 Pro Max. It's got three really decent lenses on them, which can do some extraordinary things, especially with the third-party app. So you can get a lot of mileage out of it. And also, because we were changing and running around and things like that, changing the lenses in the middle of things was a little tricky.
Well, and also there is the element of, because everyone's filming, you would see what the setup is on the
very true.
And actually, you know, so we didn't want to end up putting so much gubbins on it that it looks like a sort of iPhone come Arri.
Well, then also they're like, hang on, that last shot you had a 50 mil lens, yeah, and now you got a 25 mil. Like, you had to keep it the same.
Yeah.
You were clever, because I once did a 5-camera thing a film ages ago, and they're supposed to be news things, but like 4 of them are red cameras, right. And I was like, nobody will notice. And we find, yeah, and you look over, and it's just like a focus puller.
Like, with his own little box, doing his own thing.
Yeah.
That was for Being Souls, wasn't it, Phil, that you did in 2 days? Shot in 2 days, this movie is incredible. It's incredible.
That's with Chris,
Chris
Dane,
yeah,
as well. Let's just carry on talking about the camera techie geeky stuff, because it is actually really important, because Phil's exactly right. People do say, you've got a phone in your pocket, you can shoot, and you absolutely can shoot on what is in your pocket. However, to make films as good as you guys have done, it's really important to have these accessories. And the fact that you're saying that, you know, Cinema P3 is £30 and they're at the end of a telephone.
I mean this was last year,
all right, so, but let's inflation,
it's not a lot,
100 at the most. Still, that's worth it, right? By the way, let's see if we can get sponsored from them.
I'll give you his email. Joke. Like, yep. It's a nice thing.
But that sounds, those type of things are so important for people to know, to say, well, actually, we can do that, but these little extras make the film better. What else?
Yeah. It's the sound. The sound for me, it sounds like bad sound for me can kill a really good film anyway.
Yep.
So we've always, right from the beginning, like, so we make sure everyone's mic'd up. We had hidden mics. We had backups of things. We were always checking the sound. Yeah. So that was a dialogue. But then we, as we've always done with us, and it's really, really tedious, and we're not huge fans of it anymore, it's Foley. We take out every sound in the film, every little chair squeak, rustle of whatever, you know, we take it all out. I mean, a lot of it these days, you've got great libraries, so a lot of it is electronic, like footsteps, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then, you know, Tori and I were having to, you know, bang doors, rustle things, you know, and send everything over to Will, the editor, checks, does it work? Everything was, you know, no one will ever notice any of that stuff, but they will notice if it's bad.
Yeah.
You know, and you're just going to be, you know, even if it's subconsciously, like, this is shit.
Especially in a horror.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and you can't control it. We wanted to control things. You know, we wanted to go, okay, there's no birds now. You know, or no, then this is when we bring this in. You can't have any extraneous stuff that you can't control.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. And you guys did that yourselves after you know, in the middle of the edit, and then you did the Foley. You pretty much did all the Foley for the film.
Yeah.
We did about 40%. Will did
a lot. Our editor, who also did our sound mix,
yes, he's great.
And design.
Will Honeyball is amazing.
The legend.
Yeah.
He did a lot from library, but we did.
But because that's also why I love 40, having him on.
Was it only 40%?
I know, it felt like a lot longer. But there's a lot of noises though. All those crows, evil crows and stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of crows. We didn't do
evil crows.
We didn't do the evil crows.
Oh, you didn't.
Did
you? No. One now for us. Go on.
No, because basically.
Did you do the Welsh chanting?
Because I did do a little bit of Welsh.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, we had real Welsh speaking people, and then we had a few people. I was part of the Blood Cult Chorus. Although, sneaky.
That's like a great band.
No, yeah, Blood Cult Chorus. Thank you. But I did do a sneaky little, actually, I don't know. I don't know how to say that. Basically, 1982 Excalibur.
Yes.
Which I'm obsessed with.
Yeah.
There's a line from that Merlin says, which actually I think then I was like, oh, no one's ever seen this. And I saw they did it in Ready Player One. I'm like, oh shit. Someone else knows about it. Anyway, there's this kind of Welsh phrase I've been obsessed with since I was about 10. So I sneakily just whispered it into my iPhone. Yeah. Sitting here, like, I was like, oh, Will, I've got an idea. Can you put this in the film? Just put it into my iPhone, and it's in about 3 times. Like, just in the background. Going, da, 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 da.
Anyway, but that kind of stuff's cool, though, because it's your sound designing the movie. It's your vision. It's you're putting your thumbprints and voices all over, and sounds from your house all over a film that you shot, you know, months ago. It's beautiful and incredible, and just only adds to the beauty of your film. Right,
and it happens on all budget levels. I've literally just been in a mix.
Oh, really?
Well, and you
like, we're like, oh, we need this. We need this. Yeah, no, we need this voice, or oh, can you? We need this breath, or can you?
Yeah,
you know,
like, yeah, yeah, yeah,
and,
sure.
And there was a bit in the thing that I need a kid need to shout a line.
So Phil did it.
So I went and did it on a mic.
Did you?
And yeah, I said, yeah. So it's like my cameo. Did it on a mic, and I sat there going, you know, if you want to pitch it to someone as a kid, you know, you'll be fine. And they went, no, no, we're good.
You sound great.
You just did like, it. Damn it. No, you actually do sound like a 12-year-old. Okay.
Give us the line, Phil. Can you give us the line?
Yeah, which character is it? We'll look out for it.
It was someone shouting, missed me.
That's good.
12-year-old kid, Phil. That's perfect. There we go. You should sign up with voiceover agents. That's really good.
No, but what I'm saying is like, you know, there's this idea of the kind of DIY filmmaking, but actually we're using all the tools all the time on everything that we do. And it's just fun that like it still comes down to someone with a mic in a room doing something to the film.
Well, they do it on, like I say, so, Phil says, you do it on so many movies, you know, big movies like Jason Statham doesn't breathe at the right time in a film. Someone's in a booth, usually the sound recordist or person just go, you know what I mean? Yeah. And they add it in. It,
exactly.
I've done it on most of the films and people just do this. It is normal, everyone. If you haven't done this before, don't worry. It's fine. It's no one notices who's breathing as long as you've got the breath.
We were doing some ADR for it. And then I think Matt Barber was filming. So Graham did bits of Matt Barber.
Yeah.
And like his dying and that kind of stuff. Like little bits of
gurgle. Death gurgle. Like no one notices. It's, and it just, you
which
need
I can
it.
Hear, I'm like, that's northern. That's
well, and also I think as an actor, like when you...
did Matt notice?
Graham, he's like, oh no, I'm dying. and Matt's Downton Abbey. Oh, yeah, I'm dying.
Yes, yeah, so, no, I'm absolutely dying.
But also screams and stuff like that. Like as an actor, you don't know. Like if
Riz
you...
really struggled to scream.
Well, yeah. Like, I don't think I can do that.
Yeah. It's really hard. Just so people are aware, we haven't named the cast yet, but the leads are Riz Moritz and Ellie Duckles, alongside Tori Butler-Hart herself, who plays a fantastic role in it, of Tori. Matt Barber is in it, Emma King, Graham, we've mentioned, is Graham Butler, which is Matthew's brother and Tori's brother-in-law. And then we've got Hattie Chapman and also Luca Thompson as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, he's the professor. So he turns up, because we're obviously in the found footage, within the found footage, we've got another bit of found footage.
Yes, you have. You've got a third.
Yeah. I told you. Yeah. Like, you know.
Which is my slight nod to kind of Evil Dead, but like when they go and find the tapes, so they go and find like videotape. I mean, we could have
I
done
think it would be fun to do a prequel where, and then all of that.
Well, I want to do a conventional version of this, to be honest.
But you could do this as the 360 goggle version we're talking about.
The immersive
Gogo vision from the monster's POV. This is the monster's.
Oh.
He's
360, okay, nice.
Right?
It's, just in the shadows.
Yeah, just hello. Yeah. Does he speak? Does he? Is that how he speaks? Well,
hello. I'm a monster.
Chills down my spine.
It's just perfect. This is terrifying.
Did you? And this like a tone question, guys. Tone question. Mm. Did you know or think it was going to be funny at times, or were you like trying to? Because obviously, and I want side question as well. Because Tori, you're not only having an emotional performance, and you're filming yourself, and you're producing, and all this stuff. It's like so many different hats. And I want to get in a question about how do you stay kind of objective, about what you're doing. Obviously, playing it straight and it's scary and emotional and stuff, but you know, a lot of great horror has comedic release, and obviously, you know, your amazing leads are great bants with each other and they have wonderful comic timing. Did you, Tori, did you know that going in that you wanted it to be light at times? Because I saw it twice, right? I saw it at home by myself, which is a very different experience to sat in a cinema watching it with an audience with people laughing and jumping. And it was a great communal experience kind of watching it in that way. So tone-wise, is that something you were looking for? Is it something that came in the edit?
Because the original script, like, it is meant to be silly. Like, you know, the whole point was we're not massive. Like, we don't like arms and legs.
But it's
coming
not a spoof.
It's not a spoof. No. We didn't want to take the Mickey.
We do quite like making things that sort of slightly fuck with people.
Yeah, like blur the lines. Like, like 1 minute it's funny, and then she's falling out the window. Is that funny? And then
cut to
she's bawling her eyes. You know, to kind of like. Which people kind of responding pretty well to, which is nice. And because, you know, a lot of the sort of films for us, especially found footage things, if they just go straight into all the horror-y bits, I'm like, well, I don't really care about these people.
Yeah.
So, like, we've got to make people care about that. That's, for me, I mean, you know...
Whether you like them or you don't like them, at least there's some sort of...
Like, I'd rather people kind of cared about the actors and then some of the scares being Brit. Like, fine, but I care about the people. Like, that's... You're going to remember that, to be honest. Yeah, I'm not an arms and legs coming off kind of guy. So that's always, as a director, that's my focus. It's like, it's got to be the characters, obviously. You both directors, you know this. So that was and we always wanted to play around with silliness.
Not only are you performing and acting, but you're also filming. So you've got to have half of your brain sort of on that as well, and the framing and that kind of thing. And so that was a lot to ask of a very young actor that didn't have much experience in front of the camera. And so that sort of led us to, well, actually, let's go a little bit older with the casting, who can play younger. And I'd done a job in Belgium where Ellie actually played my daughter, and Riz was Ellie's friend. And so we, and I remembered them. And
how dare they cast you as a mother?
She was like a goddess. Like a goddess mother who's kind of like immortal.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, can make lightning come out of the sky and stuff.
Just, thanks, Matt, for clarifying.
But, don't worry, Matt, I did it for you, okay?
But they were both awesome. And so I contacted them separately and said, you know, would you guys be up for this? Would you be interested? And I said, you know, do you remember one another? And they were like, oh, yeah, no, we kept in touch. And so actually it was just really fortuitous that they were still mates and sort of got together and hung out a bit more and talked about the characters. And they both lived with people who were early 20s.
Like, we wanted it to be funny, but like, we don't want to go too far, so we don't want it to be a spoof. Definitely don't want it to be a spoof. But I mean, footage wise we have so many different versions of everything. In the edit, we could make a fully straight version, or we could make a ridiculous romp all the way through as well. So it was a lot of it was in the edit. You know, and that's when we were like, okay, I mean, every film you never really know what you've got, but then with this stuff, you're like, oof, okay, we've got a lot of footage to go through. Let's properly piece this together and play with that tone. And, you know, we could have balanced one way or the other. But then, as Tori said, we like to play around. So people think it's this, and then it becomes that. And then, oh, but is it this?
And Tori, how do you find it? I know you've done it a few times in your films, but how do you find yourself like watching yourself in the edit with the producer hat on, going like, well, that's terrible. Who hired that person? Or, wow, I think she's great in this. Or, like,
no, Phil, or can Phil, you totally... I can categorically say that never happens. Never have I watched myself and gone,
the terrible one.
Chris, I'm good.
I love this version of you as the commercials director, by the way. And now in my head, this is how you are on set. I love it.
Lines did blur there as well. I just want to point out slightly when I was trying to. No. As in, it's not.
Samus, I am nothing.
That's not what I'm saying. But when we were on set, I'd be trying to talk to Emma and Matt. So this is what I want to happen. I'd always go, but what I think we should do, we're going to do this. And then I was like, okay, cool. But for your perspective, with your cameras, the actual film bit, which is over here, I need this. Fine. Took a few days to realise not actually in the direction.
Getting back in your lane.
That's what I mean about the line.
I'm not actually directing.
But do you have any tips? Like, we're in the edit and stuff. Do you have any tips? You hear all the time people acting things and make things and get out there and do stuff, which is great, but it's still really difficult to watch yourself and edit yourself and have that objectivity for the audience. Things like,
I think that's
how do you find it?
Just nailed it. Like, I think that's the thing. You've just got to be objective, and just get over yourself, get over the ego, leave the ego at the door. You know that, and try and, you know, just look at yourself, watch yourself as, you know, as just another actor, just another actor, but, you know, as the same, on the same way that you would view all of the other characters, and remember the story as a whole. And, you know, and
because I like actors to watch playback, which a lot of people don't, but so I try and instill this in all the actors. Everyone's like, oh, I don't want to watch myself. I'm like, just for now, put a director's hat on. Just what would you need this person to do to tell this story a little bit, maybe a little bit clearer, or maybe you want to hide something. Like, think of it like that point of view, and you quite quickly can get over,
you can.
Oh, that's me. You go, okay, what does that
and you learn so much as an actor from watching yourself.
I was gonna say, has it has it taught you to become a better actor? And because now you see in the edit all of your takes, every single one that most actors don't ever see. Never.
Yeah, no, I mean, pretty much, yeah. And I think, but actually I think a lot of the actors on this did. Because quite a lot of the time we would be watching playback in situ. Because actually it becomes sort of less about the performance. I mean, it is as much about the performance, but equally it's about, did we get that shot right, that angle right, that, you know, that swipe, was it quick enough? Did
I actually, as an actor, how can I help that moment? Which I, I love actors who understand this technical thing, which is why we ended up, one of the many reasons we ended up going with Riz and Ellie, because they were a little bit older, they had more experience with the camera, so we could talk about things from a more technical point of view. And they would be able to kind of incorporate that into their performance. Like, how can they help the edit at this point? What do they need visually and physically to kind of make our life easier in the edit, rather than having to kind of create a moment?
And there's there's a lot of that with found footage, because there are so many kind of cheats and stuff just to, so that the mechanics can work. You know, because like all of the sweeps and all of that kind of stuff you need in there, because otherwise Will doesn't have anything, he can't cut. You could, because it's, you know, that's the whole, I mean, we allowed ourselves a bit of free rein with that, because it was at the very beginning of the film, it says this footage has been put together by filmmakers. Mm-hmm. So we did allow ourselves a little bit of leeway there in, you know, being able to kind of, you know, cut around stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think for a movie like this, it's absolutely so important that the actors do look at that, because they're holding the cameras. So therefore, it's technical as well as performance. And hopefully a lot of actors, when they watch footage back, are worrying about their performance, because that's all they're looking at. Whereas in this case, they were looking at technical ability, which is fascinating. Before we dive into Cinema Run and other bits on set, can I just ask about the money, the finances, because our audience will be asking, and they say, you know, again, it was very low budget, but we've never really clarified what it was or how you got it. So obviously you got the cameras from Apple for free. You got a location, which you paid for. Where was the rest of it coming from? Obviously you've got to feed people, you've got to put them up, even though maybe you probably all stayed in that location anyway. Talk us through that, how you managed to go, right, this is what we're doing. You've got your date, you're moving forward. Talk us through just...
So you'd be honest, I mean... So because we've, you know, made a few films, we basically went back to the same investors, because our other films had done well enough that they've been getting their money back, so we could go back to them. But, you know, we'd had to make short films in the first place. So Anthony Pigeri, for example, who's been amazing since our first film, we made some tiny, literally like £500 short films years ago. We showed those to him, and he was like, okay, great. Well, here's the first bit of money. That was for Two Down. And then each film we've been really lucky, to be honest.
He's just been amazing.
To be able to go back and say, it never gives, you know, it's not a huge amounts or sort of all of it, but it's enough to get started with stuff. And once you have some of it...
It's enough to get you started. And you say lucky, but also it's so important that you keep those relationships well. And you've done that by keeping those relationships healthy with your investors. Because sometimes people don't. And they just go, yeah, well, they invested in that, but I don't want to speak to them anymore. And it's really important, as you filmmakers have proved, doesn't matter how much they put in, you've proved that they're repeat offenders.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, that a lot of people kind of fall into kind of cavalier attitude of like, oh, well, I've made my film now, so, you know, it doesn't really matter about the investors. But actually, if you look after your investors and you make sure that they get, might not be all of their money back, and it might take many years, but, you know, if they get something back, if you don't take all of it and you make sure that you give back, then it will keep, you know, they will keep coming back, which is the only way that you can make this sustainable.
Yeah, and we've built those relationships over over a decade now. So it started small, it started with a short, you know, and built. Exactly. It's just kind of keep, you know, just not being a dick, isn't it? It's the old
It's about not being a dick. So you did. So you went back to investors and you managed to raise. Do you want to say how much budget you raised?
But we made the actual. Boots on the ground. I keep saying boots on the ground. That sounds very World War II, but why not? That was like 15 grand. And then we spent the same on post-production.
Yeah.
Then we have to go and make...
Amazing.
We have to go and find about the same for the P&A, all the distribution costs,
yeah,
DCPs, all that kind of stuff, which everyone, including us, always sort of forget about. You know, because we're doing a lot of like the PR, especially for the UK and Ireland ourselves, to save money. But like you still need money for adverts and for stuff.
I think so all in, it's been 40, 45.
Yeah, but to make the actual film... 30 grand, yeah. But, you know, so we got the first amount, made the film, got like a little teaser, did a little bit of crowdfunding, went to other investors, went, look, we've made the film. It's kind of a more, that's not a sure bet, but as in like, we've made it now. It's an easier gamble. And it's all gambling.
It's in the can.
Yeah. that's thrown me slightly.
I could tell. I quite enjoyed that.
Boots on the ground.
Boots on the ground.
Matt just went.
You see my eyes like, hey, what? Where are we?
It's a dead circle, guys.
That's too much Easter chocolate, isn't it? There you go. Yes, we did it bit by bit. So we had the first amount. We were able to show something, get some more. Able to show, we've now got the whole thing.
We've got the giggles, too much Easter chocolate. What kind of chocolate were you eating?
And it's like literally 4 days ago.
It's been a really long week.
Like a week ago.
We're doing deliverables for America.
It was a week ago.
Yeah.
Was it really?
Yeah.
But deliverables, yeah, and all that stuff. And DCP, for those that don't know, is literally, does it mean digital cinema?
Yeah.
Package, which is basically, it's basically your film on a hard drive. So it would be, in the old days, it would be what you would give to a cinema as a reel of the film in 5 reels. Now you can just
It can only be played on a cinema. Yeah. So it's not, you can't just shove your film onto a hard drive.
Or even more brilliantly, you don't even have hard drives anymore.
That
it's
really
just
threw me.
Digital.
Just give it to the Landsat people and they just do it.
Still got
to
pay
you
as much.
Pay them. Still got to have the DCP made.
Absolutely.
Of course.
And then quad posters and then postage. Yeah. It's all these little tiny things. You're like, wow, we've just spent a load of money there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with that cost then, I mean, you know, do you actually think, because you think it's cheaper, in inverted commas, to make a iPhone film, but do actually, is it really, when you think about it? Because there's certain costs that are the same, right?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
But you haven't got as many crew for a start. You haven't
you
got the huge, you know,
crew.
If we were having you were using a lovely Arri Alexa, one, it needs a lot more people. And don't get me wrong, I love Arri and would love to play with one of those again. But you need a bigger crew. You need bigger, you need vans. We didn't have to have vans for any of our equipment.
Yeah.
You know, all these little tiny knock-ons. And like, well, then you need parking. And then you need more, there's more people and there's more hotels. There's more food. Or, you know, there's a big knock-on
effect. Yeah, exactly.
Which is why, you know, again, we'd love to do another conventional film, bigger budget, but still on iPhone. Because it also just gives you so much more. I definitely don't work for Apple. Because it gives you so much more time to play with the actors. Because you go, let's reset. If you've lit it like we did with the found footage, let's go again. Let's go again. And the reset
is stepping back.
You know what I mean? So you can play with the actors.
You don't have the setup time.
Yeah. And as someone that's, you know, I feel kind of kindred spirits the way that we make things, to hear you say that actually let's make something bigger but an iPhone is kind of fascinating to me because, as I said, the first time you did it, and because of pandemic and you shot it like during lockdown and stuff, right?
Yeah.
It didn't look like an iPhone film. It just didn't. It absolutely didn't. So I can see how you're able to do that. So it's funny that actually you're still thinking about it's actually a viable format, a viable camera format, and not just some, you know,
the cameras are getting
low budget
better.
Knock-off.
They're trying to actively make it better for filmmakers. Like, you know, they have these kind of round table things and we'll be on it and Ben Wheatley and everyone's like asking questions like, look, we'd love it if you could do this.
Yes.
So they're making changes specifically for this. They know you're not going to use it to shoot Dune, but, you know, in the bigger films, maybe it's a little element that's going to speed things up.
I'm so excited.
Can't wait to see an iPhone on a Technocrane. A little iPhone on a crane.
On that, do you feel anyone could reach out to Apple and ask, is this a very specific thing to ask for to use their iPhones and be sent phones?
That's all we did, to be honest. We shot Infinitum.
Are we going to get in trouble now?
I mean,
Just the email address.
No, but again, everything. So, you know, I just. was on the internet. So after we shot Infinitum, I was like, I'll just let Apple know about it. Like, we've done this. And they were like, well, we're always getting sent feature, you know, films on shot on iPhone. They went, oh shit, oh, this is a proper film. Oh, okay. And then they kind of got behind us and they went, well, we need to kind of cultivate this, especially if you're, you know, wanting to do more of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I just called the email.
Yeah. I think that's the thing is that, yeah, obviously we're not the first people to make a film on iPhone and be like, hi, Apple, we've made a film. You know, I think, yeah. But again,
it was cultivating the relationships as well. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, that, you know, this goes back 4 years now. So then we can go, look, we're making a film. Can you support us, you know, a little bit and hopefully with the PR and that sort of stuff? Mm. And then they go, great, well, that worked out well. What else are you doing? And then it's slowly building up. We're not being too quick with things, we're not being too greedy, and just slowly building up, kind of, you know, right, that relationship.
Which is really important, because basically it's saying filmmakers out there, you can do exactly what Matt and Tori have done and reach out and say, hey, this is what we're doing, or this is what we've shot. You know, Jed Shepherd is a perfect example of someone who did this with Host and then with Dash Cam as well afterwards. You know, people do it, and Apple gave them, Jed and his team as well, phones for that particular reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about Cinema Run before we dive back into tips and tricks of making a found footage. You know, look, it's just so impressive for anyone to get a movie in the cinema these days. But it is not impossible. It is doable. It is absolutely doable. It's hard work. You've got to get the audiences there. You've got to promote it. Again, like you say, and there's no money behind you by now as well, because there's nothing left. And it's your time and energy. It's very difficult. But what a cinema run does is do nothing but brilliant publicity for your film that you cannot buy. You cannot buy that publicity. Talk us through the process for you guys, because you did it with Infinitum as well as all your other films, Two Down and The Isle.
No, The Isle, because Infinitum was locked down because we were meant to be, and then they shut it all back down again as we were meant to be doing cinema.
So we did American cinema.
That was nothing to do.
But it didn't do UK in the end.
Yeah, it was meant to.
But we did it for The Isle, and for this,
So you thought you'll do it again here. What was the process behind this? Because you didn't have to. You didn't have to go, let's do a cinema tour and do the work. You could have just let's put this out. So
the main major benefit of doing a cinema run is, this isn't like a secret or anything, is it?
No, I don't know what you're gonna say, like, probably not.
Well, because it means that then your film gets on like reviewers' lists.
Empire magazine goes, oh, it's one of the best films to watch this year in the cinema.
Which is what they said about the film, Matt. Great plug there.
Oh, I forgot about that. But you can get bigger eyes. Bigger publications that would just go, this is a 30 grand film. We're not going to look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's doing cinemas now. Yeah. So, okay, well, there's got to be something in it. So they do look at it, and then...
Well, and this actually goes on a kind of directory.
Yeah, then you get to go on the FDA.
Yeah, it's still a very traditional thing of like how you access a certain type of journalist and publication if you're in a cinema.
Exactly.
That still hasn't changed.
Yeah. And you've got to do a minimum of 10 screens, I think it still is. Yeah, I think that's still the case. So that's a really good reason to do it and to put in the work and the effort, because actually the knock-on effect is that you get those reviews. Yes, you hope that they're good, but even if they're terrible, at least people are talking about it and they know about it. Yeah,
absolutely.
But also, for us, it's the thing of like, because, you know, it's selected cinema, so it's small little bits, bobs here, there, Q&A tour, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. But it's all over the place and all the social media stuff, and people go, oh yeah, I saw that film. So when it comes out digitally, they're more likely to watch it.
Yeah,
exactly. It basically, rather than trying to start from a week or two before the film comes out, it's been, you know, we were touring for 7 weeks, I think, from the beginning of February.
We had a week off, so it was like six.
Yeah, it was over eight, but it was actually 7 weeks.
Was it?
Yeah, insanity. Yeah. But like, you know, it was everywhere. Like pretty much, well, most of the loads of big cities all over the UK. Mm. And we had posters obviously up and people talking about it and stuff. So it's just that people go and it comes out.
And the great thing about Q&As, well, actually, I mean, first of all, it's a 50-50 split. So, you know, so usual cinema run, like the cinemas will take like 70% and the filmmakers end up with, you know, nothing basically. Yes. But with Q&As, it's 50-50, which makes it, you know, more worthwhile. It'll cover your petrol costs and whatever else it is to get to, you know, Whiz Beach.
Was a fun one.
It was great. Thanks, Whiz Beach was awesome. But then you... What I was going to say was, like, the main really lovely thing is that you do these Q&As and actually then you are firsthand engaging with your audience.
Yeah.
And you know, and you get to feel a feedback of what they think of the film. Mm. And, you know, and those are the people who are going to support you and who are going to support your film. And
yeah, if they like it and they've seen it in the cinema and they've met you, you've got fans of the film who will, when it comes out, go, I saw this, you've got to watch it. It's better than any kind of advertising we can do, realistically.
Word of mouth is always the best. Yeah. You can't beat it.
You cannot beat it. They will be the ones who write on Amazon, on IMDb. And again, please, people who are listening to this now, if you've seen the film, and I really urge you to watch the film if you haven't after this, is do go on Amazon Prime and do go on IMDb and just rate it. It makes such a difference. Write something cool if you've got the time. But honestly, it makes such a difference for the filmmakers, for other people
seeing it.
But for what you're saying there is, people who do turn up at the cinemas, they will go and do that because they've met you. And by meeting the filmmakers makes you have a connection and you say hello afterwards. And those people who come up, they're your friends. They're like filmmaking friends for life as well. They'll follow what you're doing.
Exactly. And also what's so wonderful is that they are also filmmakers more often than not. You know, or they're writers or they're artists. And actually it's that whole thing of giving back. Like you always say, you know, remember to send the elevator back down. And that's, it's so like, but it's actually just... It's all about community, isn't it? And about connecting. And that's what I love about doing the Q&As is that, you know, you meet people who are from, you know, all over the country, in all different...
And they might not have access to the resources that they sort of think they need.
Yeah.
And you go and talk to them and then they're like, oh, hang on, maybe I can do the thing I've been dreaming of for 20 years.
It's so true. What about some...
It's really cool.
...tips and tricks for doing a Q&A tour? What have you learned?
So again, you don't ask, you don't get. So again, I just contacted cinemas. I find out, you know, kind of the events at The Light, things like that. The Light Cinema don't work for them, but they are amazing to support indie films. Yeah. And they like, and each cinema, the managers are so,
honestly,
film fans, and they actively try and find things to do.
Yeah. So we put 3 Day Millionaire on there, and then Light picked it up on various other places as well. So on our Q&A tour, cinema tour,
They are brilliant, aren't they? The Light are, because they, you know, they are big cinemas. I mean, because Dagger, we made for a smaller screen.
Yeah, that was another thing. Test it. What does it look like on that?
And you turn up to one of the Light cinemas and it's colossal.
Bigger than
things.
The town that we live in.
And you're like, oh, wow. Okay, there's a lot of motion sickness going on. My poor mum gets terrible motion sickness and she had to sort of run out in the first five minutes.
She used that as publicity.
She was the only person. No, I said that. That's what I said.
Yeah. Woman runs out of cinema.
Vomiting.
Vomiting from dizziness. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but I think it's all I did was just email people and go, this is what we're doing. Are you interested? And they go, oh, great. Well, hang on, I think it would do well here. And then, you know, so we wrote to one and then they would say, oh, get in touch with blah, 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 blah. And it built. You know, just simple as that, kind of.
The filmmakers, getting your film on in a cinema. There's only small glories in making movies, right? There's only really little windows where you go, oh, this is really nice. And being in the cinema is one of them. So, it's a real joy.
Yeah, seeing the BBFC card.
Yes.
Yeah. It still fills me with joy.
Yes, so important. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for diving and giving our audience so much knowledge about you making this. What else? Is there anything else we haven't touched on from you guys that you go, yeah, that was really important. I'd love people to take away this tip as a filmmaker out there. It doesn't have to be on found footage, but some things you've learned from making Dagger.
I think there's a couple of things. So on a found footage level, because we were so worried about upsetting like the found footage people, and we were told there are certain rules that you must do, and that dictated
the found footage people. They're under the garden shed right now, waiting for you.
They're in a forest, running around with a torch.
You're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong.
Well, no, but that's kind of what we were told. That's kind of, you know, there are certain things you've got to do and follow this template. And I do. And it dictated the story, dictated a lot of stuff. And I think it did well for us up to a point. I do wish we had been a bit more flexible with things and gone, fuck it, we'll just try this as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's some things that we kind of went, we were told we need to do this. at this point in a found footage film. Otherwise, the Reddit guys would tear us to pieces, for example. And that dictated things. And maybe that doesn't quite fit us sometimes. Yeah. I think sometimes we are usually a bit more weird or experimental. And I think sometimes we went against our instincts because we were trying to stick to kind of a template,
yeah,
which worked for us a lot of it. But I still think there's some things in there that I wouldn't
could
have
pushed the boundaries a bit.
Or just gone,
more.
Okay, what we would do is this. And I think go with that instinct. You know?
Yeah.
You only get to kind of make that film sort of once. Try that. That's kind of one
go
thing.
With your again,
or three times within itself.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, you only know that by hindsight.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, go because it's such an instinctual process, found footage anyway. You kind of go, oh, let's try. Okay, that worked. Let's try this. Just, I wish we delved more into that, even story wise. Okay. I think I was a little bit scared about things. And you can't, you know, you can't worry about what other people think at the end of the day, because it's impossible to please everyone. You can only do, you know, you can only make the film that you want to see. So there's some bit, you know, I love watching it. I genuinely think it's a fun film. There's still some bits I'm like, we fell down a certain trap because we were kind of led that way.
Yeah.
And I wish we'd just gone bollocks to that. Let's try this.
Got you.
You know, be a bit more fizz and ginger about it. I think.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I still think you've pushed it though.
I
think you've elevated it hugely, and it was refreshing for me. You know, in that way, it definitely felt, you know, joking about the whole Inception version, but generally for that's what really made it interesting for me. I was like, oh, this is a cool idea.
Mm.
This is a cool concept I haven't seen before. And I think that's a triumph. So we always beat ourselves up.
Yeah.
But like,
as in, you know, like,
that was a great
idea. You know, rather than just going, glory, well done us. It's kind of like, okay, what did we learn? How can we go forwards?
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, maybe I take that idea and that knowledge into a conventional film as well, you know, and you know, because we now as a team kind of have a certain set of skills to kind of be able to play more, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we can
and I
do
think,
that.
I think that's the thing, play, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, I think that's, yeah, I think that would definitely be the tip. Because also, and we found this with Infinitum as well, the whole nature of shooting a film on a phone, it means, gives you license to play because it is so small and maneuverable and adaptable. And so actually, I think, you know, if you've got that, the 20 minutes or whatever, just like, and you think that you've got everything, just do it again,
but just
do something totally different, like totally, totally different.
I'd like to bring that into conventional films,
yes,
like whether it's favorite or iPhone or not. But you go, just, I, you know, and I've always been a little bit reticent with actors as well to go,
yeah,
fuck it, just try something else. But this one was like, I'm not going to give you notes. My only note is do something different, which I've never done because it's a bit of a wanky note. But at the same time, every actor rose to the occasion and they did something which was unexpected. And I'm like, great. I would never have thought of that. Let's just go for it.
Yeah, because I think as a producer, like, you know, if you sort of wrap kind of 10, 20 minutes earlier and you're like, whoa, you know, great. All the crew's going to be really happy about this. I think I'd just be like pushed for like, no, let's just go for a fuck it one, you know? And I think we haven't done that maybe enough in the past. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's a big takeaway.
Just work them right to the last minute.
but not a minute
of. Yes, exactly.
Because then you've got to pay.
Love it. Listen, you guys are amazing. Congratulations again. Daggers are absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thanks, folks.
For your debut found footage movie, it's blown it out of the water and the found footage fans have gone crazy for it. Have so many of the reviews, and like you said at the start, it was 90% good reviews. Hey, I think any filmmaker out there would take 90% good reviews.
We're early doors.
Early doors, but you're still 8.3 on IMDb and you've been around a long time. That's incredible. It really is for that, so congrats. It's really good. So Pete, people, please do go watch Dagger. Link to it will be in the show notes. And like Matt and Tori have done, you can go out there and make a film should you wish. You've got a phone in your pocket, for God's sake.
Just download the app.
Just download the app.
Make film now.
But you can, as Matt and Tori have done, is think about it. Think about what you're going to do. Think about the tone. Think about the apps you use, the filters, if you're using iPhone. If you're doing a conventional film, well, how are you going to make it different? What what's your strategy, and get out there and make it and put it into cinemas. Do your Q&A tour and turn up to all those Q&A tours, and people will come and they'll see your film and like it. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty to
send the elevator back down.
As Tori has said so brilliantly earlier in the episode. Thank you very much, Phil Hawkins, for joining us on this episode.
No, thank you. This is
very
fun.
Much fun. Matthew Butlerhart, thank you.
Thank you both very much.
Tori, thank you.
Thank you, Giles. Thank you, Phil.
All right. Go out there, make your films, people. We will see you next Tuesday when we have a scoop for you with Netflix's scoop with Rufus Sewell and Keely Hawes, along with the director and producer next week and the week after. It looks like we've got Zack Snyder. Don't tell anyone yet. But yes, it's it looks like we're recording with him next week. Might all fall apart, you know what it's like. But Zack Snyder.
That's awesome.
So, that's fun. But, thanks for squeezing us in.
Yeah. They're going to be like, great, great. What?
We've got Jurassic Park. Okay. We've got Top Gun.
Netflix did actually say, because Scoop's like out now as well going, why isn't Scoop out coming this year? And we said, because we've got Dagger. I was like, no, Dagger first. Yeah, told right. Netflix. Thanks. Said Dagger first. So, yeah,
thanks.
What do you mean?
And they went, boom. You what?
Yeah, they did. Like, okay, thanks for letting us know.
Again,
those fizz and ginger. But brilliant. Again, listen, you're amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. So much knowledge imparted to our lovely listeners. So do thank them. Find them on the socials and say thank you. They're amazing. We will see you next Tuesday, because I've just said it will be. Shut up. Let's get off. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye.